Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
But today, we've reached the pedestal pinnacle, Brian, the final episode of our 2005 miniseries, where we look back, sometimes fondly, sometimes with fury, at the year that was. If you had to say, are you feeling more furious or fond?
I was just thinking, usually you're the one with the fury.
Usually. That's fair.
I happen to think the Oscars always get it right.
Wow. Okay, well, let's see. This year, we'll get into it. In 2005, the nominees for Best Picture were Good Night and Good Luck, Capote, Brokeback Mountain, Munich, and the year's big winner, Crash.
Coming up in the finale show, we'll reorder the top five. We'll ask each other a question, talk a little trivia, the grand reveal, which is where we will put in our own personal top fives, regardless of the Oscars. We might kick a few other Oscar picks and golden take.
And you were just saying off mic, you watched like over 30 movies.
I watched 31 movies. Series. I keep telling myself each time that I'm going to like limit it and really only watch the ones that I know are probably candidates.
Yeah.
And this time I watched some that I did not really think were going to be candidates and I ended up liking certain things about them a lot.
Yeah.
For example, I really liked the end of Broken Flowers. Did you see that one?
Yeah. It's been years ago.
It was pretty painful for most of it. And my wife hated the movie with a passion, but I kind of liked the ending. Also, I watched In Her Shoes, which you recommended.
Yeah.
And I did not think it was going to be in the top five and it's not. But I'm glad I watched it. It was pretty good movie. Yeah.
And Toni Collette just doing more good work in that. She's great and everything.
Absolutely.
I always kind of feel like if I've seen them
she's added to the list then. She's great in everything.
I think so. Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Giamatti.
Catherine Keener. Toni Collette.
That's about it so far.
The list is growing.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah. I don't know.
He's my list.
Okay.
All right. Reordering the Best Picture nominees.
Yeah, so not to overstate it, but the fact that Crash beat Brokeback Mountain is a crime against humanity. And I don't want to overstate
against humanity.
And I don't want to overstate the point here.
I don't think that's overstating anything.
Not only should it not have beaten Brokeback Mountain, but it is firmly my number five of these nominees. My number four is Munich, and then I go Good Night and Good Luck, and then Capote, and then Brokeback Mountain. How about you?
Quite a different order. Crash, though, we are united in that's number five out
of
five.
Okay, good.
Which is kind of interesting.
Makes me happy that you put it down at the bottom there.
That I supposedly got it right.
Yeah, you got it right.
My number four was Capote, not because I didn't like Capote, but I've always had a soft spot for my number three, Good Night and Good Luck. I like movies about journalists and I like black and white, you know. My number two is Brokeback Mountain and number one is Munich.
All of the goodwill that you built with me by putting Crash as number five is burnt to the ground right when you'd put Capote as the number four. I feel like...
I like Capote. That's the thing with a lot of these, like there's a lot of movies that didn't make my top five that I'm like, two thumbs up, cheer them on, like Brick.
Yeah.
We did an episode about Brick. It's not in my top five, but it's not like I have anything really bad to say about it. It's just that, you know, it's so subjective. You know, I was looking at other critics' lists, I always do, and it's amazing sometimes how little overlap there can be. You know, somebody's number one doesn't even make somebody else's top 10 list. So I don't know. I've kind of come to terms with that. Just everybody has different tastes. It's fine. That's one of the reasons why it's so great that there's so many different movies available. You can find that your new favorite movie, you know, anytime.
And that's why the world needs shows like Best Picture This that tears down the establishment, right?
Desperately needs shows like
I mean, who's the Academy to tell us what the best five movies of the year are?
Actually, I don't think it needs any more shows like this. I think this could be the last.
Yeah, this is it.
The last and the best.
I think we did it.
All right, questions.
You kind of answered my question. I was going to ask you if you had sort of a surprise, something that's not going to be in your top five, but something that
well,
stood out to you.
My question to you is, what was your biggest surprise find of the year? So apparently we're on the same page.
We are on the same page.
Actually, I have a secondary question in case you ask the same one. So I can totally read minds here.
All right, good.
My other question, and then we'll get to that one, is Brokeback Mountain a top five of the decade for you?
Ooh, of the decade 2000 to 2010?
No, 2000, 2009, inclusive 10 years, of course.
Okay. Well, we're about to embark on 2006.
We are. We're halfway through.
So we haven't looked at 3 years
indeed
here. But of the ones that we've done so far, I would have to put it in consideration, but yeah, it's tough because, I mean, I think Eternal Sunshine and Mulholland Drive, yeah, those are going to be easily in my top five. And then I think about Punch Drunk Love. That seems like one that's got to be on there. Now that's three. I've only got two spots left.
Indeed.
So it would come down to maybe the number four or five.
Yeah.
And I would have to do some really deep soul searching.
But it's definitely a candidate for a top five for the decade for you.
It would be a candidate for serious consideration, but that's as much as I'll commit.
A candidate to be considered as a candidate.
Yeah, because you know that some movies, they're not going to be candidates. At least with Brokeback.
The best picture winner is doesn't make the top 500 for some.
No, I think that's totally fair. But as far as surprises go,
yeah,
I'd seen all of these movies pretty much before. And the ones that I hadn't, none really stuck out as ones that I loved. Mm-hmm. So as far as rewatches go, I'll say rewatching Red Eye. Mm. I'd seen it before in theater. Mm-hmm. I knew that I liked it then, but I just popped. It's 85 minutes. I had some time to burn and I just had so much fun with it. And
you had 86 minutes to burn. Thought this is perfect. 85.
Yep. The 1 minute it takes to turn the TV on and go to HBO Max or whatever it was on. But I don't know. It's just kind of a reminder that they don't really make movies like that anymore. Like a tight hour and a half, kind of a mid-budget, star-driven, very small focus thriller. And it works so well. So it's kind of like, why don't they make these anymore? Why is every movie that I see at the movie theater now 2.5 hours long?
We talked about this on the way out of the studio last time, and it's, you got to get your money's worth.
I guess so.
If you're going to plunk down that 10 bucks, you need 2.5 hours worth of fun, not 85 minutes.
I don't know, 85 minutes of good, solid fun? I'm in all day.
So my top five is all movies I had never seen.
Really? Okay.
That was kind of funny to see, but there were a couple that I rewatched that I was really strongly considering to be in the top five, and they just couldn't quite pull the trigger, but I want to mention them.
Okay.
Cinderella Man. I thought, this is a movie Mike's going to hate. He's never going to want to watch this one or do a bonus on it. But I rewatched it and I was totally into it. In fact, it was probably the one that produced some of the strongest emotion of the year for me. And we'll get to that a little bit more with my golden take. But I also really, really liked War of the Worlds. The Spielberg, Kaminsky's the cinematographer, same duo, same year as Munich. And I'm a big Tom Cruise fan. I like sci-fi. So it was kind of like all these things were going together. So the same trio of, Spielberg, Kaminsky, Tom Cruise as Minority Report a couple of years before that, which I really liked.
Which is a great looking movie, but in a totally different way than War of the Worlds. War of the Worlds tries to sort of look like a low budget B movie, which I love about it because then it's got these really kind of big budget special effects. The film is kind of grainy.
I feel like it's a very similar aesthetic to Munich and Minority Report, actually.
Really? I think when I think of Munich, I think of gloss. When I think of War of the Worlds, I think of grit and grain.
Well, there's a certain kind of quality of the light that duo seems to use a lot, like these kind of shafts of light. And there's so many cool set pieces. They're on the run. They go into this basement, and they're being invaded and, they meet Tim Robbins, crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a lot of good things. There's some kind of weak things about it that I didn't love, but I thought it was pretty fun. Yeah, the ending was bad. The ending's really bad. They suddenly, everybody dies because of a microscopic, disease or something. I don't know. But that's not really Spielberg's fault. They could have rewritten the ending.
They could have rewritten it. And they set it up at the beginning where Dakota Fanning?
She's fantastic.
She says, with the splinter, when my body's ready, my body will push out the splinter. And just like the world pushes out the aliens.
I like that, though.
I guess. I mean, and I liked Cinderella Man, kind of. I mean, it's It was just sort of, I'd never seen it before, kind of because
So did you watch it this year?
Yeah, I watched it for this.
Yeah.
And I had never seen it prior because it sort of felt like one of those movies where I knew what to expect going in. And it was.
It is predictable. It's a boxing movie. You can kind of gather five or six things that you know for sure are going to be in it. Paul Giamatti's fantastic, as in everything.
Yeah. And you, I remember you said that the fight scenes you kind of felt like were the weakest part of the movie. They were my favorite things about the movie. I thought that Ron Howard was doing some interesting stuff there.
Yeah. Every boxing movie, you have to try something in the ring to make it a little different. And there are some pretty cool things about it. It's more just that boxing, just like any hand-to-hand combat scenes in movies, they get pretty old to me. They're kind of, I don't know. I guess they feel repetitive and predictable, but also, I don't know. It's just kind of unnecessarily gruesome sometimes. Mm. Trivia. There's just a few things that I wanted to... Actually, no, I only have two, and they're both about The New World, Terrence Malick. Terrence Malick wrote an early uncredited draft of Dirty Harry, 1971.
Wow. Doesn't seem like his like his approach. Like
this
his
was
aesthetic.
Early before he got a chance to direct his own movies. For The New World, there was over 1 million feet of film shot, and 3 different cuts of varying lengths were released. And then this Terrence Malick's next movie is going to be called The Way of Wind. It's a biblical epic about Jesus. Mark Rylance confirmed the film and said he would be playing 4 versions of Satan. If that doesn't make you want to watch this movie, I don't know what would.
Yeah, I'd heard before that Malick does that, where he'll shoot a ton of stuff, and then he kind of puts together the movie and figures it all out in the editing room. So sometimes, I think it was Sean Penn, you know, he's always sort of vocal about things, but he was mad about his part in one of Malick's movies because, you know, he filmed all this stuff that didn't make the cut. And it was kind of one of those things where you start putting the movie together and sort of the visual poetry of it, you follow that feeling rather than the narratives that, you know, are in the script. And sometimes huge chunks get cut out and then you have Sean Penn mad at you.
James Horner was really mad at Terrence Malick for The New World because a lot of his score got cut.
Wow.
So anyway, all right. So top fives, we've all been waiting for.
The big moment.
The big moment. I'll go first because I'm even more excited to hear yours.
You always say that. I don't care about yours so much, but you're thrilled about mine.
Well, I like lists in general, but I already know my list.
That's true.
A couple of, I won't talk about the near misses, but number five for me is Jarhead. It's a focus on one soldier's experience in boot camp, first Gulf War, 1990. It's directed by Sam Mendes, Jake Gyllenhaal. We should have done a bonus on this, by the way.
Yeah, we should.
Because I think we both liked it. I'm guessing it's going to be in your top five, but don't tell me yet. So he and the other recruits go from feeling like, you know, in this alien environment where everybody's yelling at them and totally different rules of engagement within their own, you know, crew, to then they go to this craving an opportunity to kill and use their weapons and their skills. And then the oil fields are set on fire. And the scenes and the shots just are breathtaking. Roger Deakins is the cinematographer, one of the all-time greats. And toward the end, the world is burning, the oil's raining down, and a horse covered in oil appears out of these shadows and approaches Jake Gyllenhaal's character. And seeing that horse come out was one of the most compelling scenes of the year for me in any of the movies. Just the way that it was kind of like, it was like begging to be like a symbol of something, you know, just so it's such a surprising thing to show up. And, it was very compelling. Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire were considered for that role. What do you think?
DiCaprio is considered for every leading man role. I think that almost has like a courtesy.
He could have done it though.
They have to just offer, you know, do you want this one? He says, no. All right. We'll get Gyllenhaal.
It's a great year for Jake Gyllenhaal with Brokeback and Jarhead. But so anyway, that's my number five. My number four is The Ballad of Jack and Rose. This is Daniel Day-Lewis's movie. It was written and directed by his wife, I believe. And I think that he was the most fascinating and powerful character created in 2005 that I saw. He's fierce, but yet he's tender with his daughter. And then he has this, like, he's afraid of being sexually attracted to his daughter, which I thought was really just, you know, compelling, dark, interesting. And then Catherine Keener, you know, just great and everything. She comes in, and the dynamic between the two families is just, it's so fascinating. I'm on the edge of my seat the whole time. It's in, it all takes place pretty much in one little house, you know, on one little commune. And it's just gripping, great movie making. It did not do all that well with critics necessarily, but that's my number four. Number three, Brokeback Mountain. Big fan of it. We had a bonus episode, so make sure to check that out. Or Mike might have something to say from his list. My number two is Munich.
Oh, wow.
Big fan of Munich. As I said, Spielberg, Kaminsky. I thought it was great acting. Big time. The themes and the tension and the personal all go so well together for me. I know we didn't really agree on that, but it really worked well for me. And my number one is The New World. Terrence Malick movie. I love the lyrical poetry of it. It's about, it's about John Smith and Pocahontas. But the lyricism, but also the sort of interior life that you understand by these characters from these really deep and just super well-written voiceovers. I've watched so many movies that irritate me when I have the voiceovers. Jarhead has an ending voiceover, which I think almost ruins the movie. Not really, but it doesn't help the movie. And there's a lot of movies where voiceovers are bad, but in this one, it kind of shows you the power that a voiceover can have.
And he uses it in such a different way too.
Yeah.
It's not really, you're not really getting the character's perspective as he's doing something that relates to that perspective. It's usually always, the movies are kind of just long montages in a way.
Yeah, it's true.
A very ethereal music and very poetic narration overlaid over the
and
whole
this,
thing.
This is why it didn't do very well with critics. Like, some critics loved it and put it on their best, and some, you know, well, it got bad reviews on Rotten Tomatoes.
Have you seen Tree of Life?
Yes, I have. That was a long time ago. I can't wait to rewatch that. And I actually have The Thin Red Line, but I haven't watched that. This is the only one. Well, I did see Tree of Life.
Because stylistically, they're pretty similar.
Yeah. Mark, do you have the clip? I sent it earlier, but I didn't know if it had time to grab it. This is the very first monologue or voiceover of Pocahontas. And half of this clip, it's like 50 seconds long. Half of it is just you're looking at the reflection in a pool of water. And on the one hand, there's not anything all that special about the pool of water. But the more you look at it and you realize, like, there's something sort of sacred about nature that he's trying to show you just by keeping your gaze on it for a little while. And in the world today, we don't really do that very much because we're running from one thing to another. And so to kind of like understand what like the Native American people might have viewed nature, I feel like it opened my eyes quite a bit by watching this. So anyway, let's play this clip where you, the second part of the clip, the visuals, you see Pocahontas from like a strange angle, very low down, and she just throws up her arms. That's what I'm doing in the studio. If you can't see me.
He's
throwing up her arms and looking up at the sky like, this is enough to have joy, you know, just being alive and being around, you know, being surrounded by this natural world. So go ahead, Mark. Thanks.
Come, Spirit. Help us sing the story of our land. You are a mother. We, your field of corn. We rise from out of the soul of you.
So the beginning of that, she says, come, Spirit, help us sing the story of our land. You are our mother, we your field of corn. So the beginning of Virgil's Aeneid is, I sing of arms and a man, a fugitive by fate. Walt Whitman in Song of Myself says, I celebrate myself and sing myself. And that's what he's doing. He's using this come sing, calling on a muse, but putting it in Pocahontas' mind. You know, this is the beginning of all the great epic poetry. And Pocahontas is thinking this. What a huge ambition from this filmmaker, Terrence Malick. And it worked so well.
Such a mood movie too.
It is.
If you can lock into it and be sort of in that pocket with it, then you're going to feel it.
Yeah.
And I made that joke before, I think with The Ballad of Jack and Rose, about if a movie focuses on on wind, if you can see wind, especially through wheat or tall grass, high art.
Very high art.
What does Terrence Malick do?
That's what he's trying to do.
Let's get the forces of nature, even the invisible ones, and see how they interact. And that doesn't discount humans' interaction with the world.
It's another one that my wife did not like. But starting out with that, I was totally hooked, locked in. It was also the first movie I watched for this year, for 2005. Mm-hmm. So I put it at the top of my list. I'm like, let's see what can unseat it. And Munich was kind of like up in the air. You know, these other five were really great, but that was my number one. Also interesting, I found the Metacritic examined 37 critics' top 10 movies of the decade.
Okay.
And compiled them by which movies made it onto a list, a critics' top 10 of the decade list. There Will Be Blood was far and away number one.
Like you're saying, it showed up on the best of the decade list, but also it showed up on that critics' best of the year.
If when 37 critics made their top 10 of the decade.
Okay.
And they just like put all those lists together and said, okay.
Which movie was on
the most
number of lists. Okay.
So like There Will Be Blood made it on 17 critics' lists out of 37, which is also fascinating that the majority did not even include it in their top 10. This is the 07, 06? No, 07.
07, yeah.
So, but two movies from 05 were mentioned multiple times, and it was Brokeback Mountain and The New World, which kind of surprised me, I guess, a little bit to see that The New World like actually made it onto that many lists. But again, Terrence Malick kind of has this sort of aura about him. Like some people are going to, you know, be very impressed. Apparently I'm one of those people, but so anyway, that is my top five.
I just think
commentary.
Well, we're going to have very different lists for one thing.
Overlap? Brokeback Mountain?
Well, our overlap is number five. I have Jarhead as my number five.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But the one last thing I'll say about The New World is I think with mood pieces like that, if the first time you watch it, you happen to be on that sort of that same wavelength with the movie.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
If you can plug in and you have that emotional response, then it's built into you. It's like imprinted, and you don't lose that, you know. But if you're tired that day or whatever, you're a little distracted, the dogs are barking, you're not going to really connect with a slow, really non-narrative Terrence Malick movie. So I think that first watch has a lot to do with where we rank movies on our personal lists and best of the decade and whatever else.
I wonder if that's also maybe like, say, Sin City. I wasn't really prepared, you know, mentally I had no idea what I was getting into watching it. It was one that's on my, you know, you'd have to go to probably top 15 to 20 to get into that range.
It's
for
in
me.
Your movies that matter list, but not in your
exactly,
top five
yeah.
or 10.
It's not one of my favorites, although there's things that I liked about it. You know, it's not like I didn't like it, but there's a lot of movies that are, like you said, there's a certain mood to them that you got to be locked in with. All right, so what's your top five?
Yeah, so Jarhead is my top five, and everything that you said is right. And you use the word alien, which I think is spot on, mm-hmm. because what Deakins is doing here, as far as you're in the desert, everything is blown out during the day, the colors, but then at night, everything is sort of a mix of different colors of shadow. That's when we get that horse coming. So everything in the movie just kind of has this unnatural feeling, mm-hmm. and I think I used this analogy with The Insider. It's the only other time that I feel like this is an action movie about inaction.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit more direct here because these characters kind of identify themselves as action heroes, but they have nothing to do. And I think that just builds such a great tension. And I've seen it a bunch of times and that tension doesn't go away. I feel like as I watch this movie, I kind of feel myself tensing up, you know, my hands are almost closed, and then I don't even realize it, and I look down and I realize, oh, I was tense. And it's just a very, very different kind of war movie for a very, very different kind of war, and I love that about it.
Yeah, Jamie Foxx is pretty great as the jerk, but with he kind of has this tenderness at the end. Also, one that watching it edited as I did, a lot of dialogue is bleeped out.
Oh yeah.
Boot camp dialogue, you know, down to PG-13, does leave out some things.
Yeah. And it's got humor in it too, a lot of war movies, I guess they do. I mean, you could go back to Full Metal Jacket. There's
you have to have comic relief in a war movie. Otherwise it's just, I don't know, it's too much.
Yeah. Yeah. But Jarhead's my number five. I wanted to get it in there. My number four.
The same number fives.
And then that is where it ends, because my four is A History of Violence. So this is the movie in my top five that feels the most like a popcorn movie. Mm. And that's because there's mystery and there's intrigue and there's mobsters in black suits. Mm-hmm. And I love all that about it. But also, I think that you can write essays. You can look at this movie as a study about identity and try to figure out what it's saying about what it means to be truly known. And I think that combination of being kind of accessible, but then also having a real depth there is really hard to pull off. And Cronenberg nails it. I don't ever hear people talking about History of Violence, and they should.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's certainly a standout. I would say it's a top 10. It was like a one to consider.
It's four.
I mean, for me, it was too. I mean, we agreed.
I mean, objectively, it's four.
We agreed that it's good and it's great. But it is interesting that I felt like when I saw it pop up on the list, or I think you recommended that we should do a bonus on it, mm-hmm. I kind of thought that it was pretty obscure. Like, it, you know, didn't really ring any bells for me at all. Interesting that Viggo Mortensen was Return of the King, Top of the World.
Yeah.
To something that's sort of like a weirdly art house popcorn combo, you know.
And Cronenberg's got a name also, so it's a little bit weird, but all I can think is that but I saw it in a megaplex here, you know, so it did have a wide enough release. But all I can think is that Cronenberg made a lot of very sort of difficult, challenging movies in his career. And I don't know, maybe this one got overlooked because of that. I don't know. But this one's not challenging in the ways that a lot of his previous work is, but intellectually I think it is, and I love it.
A lot of meat to it.
A lot of meat. Number three, it's Match Point. I got Woody Allen on the list. Mm-hmm. I love how it works as a thriller, similar to A History of Violence, mm-hmm. but also it's this quiet character study, and it weaves between all these different themes. You know, it's an adultery story sort of to start, and then it kind of weighs the comforts of love versus lifestyle. And then we're into grand themes about morality and justice. And we had a big fight about this in the episode four, Match Point. So people should go back and listen to me winning that one.
Another one where I have nothing bad to say about it. It's great. Good movie.
Yeah. It's got a lot going on, and I just love what it represents in Woody Allen's catalog too, as a fan. My number two is Brick.
Really?
Wow. Yep. Nice. I did not think that this was going to be so high on my list.
That was one of your, I mean, even though it wasn't a surprise movie, but it surprised you to move up that high.
Yeah. It's the movie that I got the most excited about after rewatching it, because I had seen all of these before, mm-hmm. and I knew that this was going to be a contender. I wasn't sure it was going to be my five, but after I watched it again, I love the genre subversion is one thing. And mm-hmm. I think that adds kind of a cool factor to this to this movie, because you have the snappy dialogue, you have like kind of all the tropes of the hard-boiled detective, and you know, the mystery with these social cliques that stand for a lot bigger things when you filter high school through film noir. But I think that there's a lot of personal stuff there too. So to have that, I guess that's a running theme here, to have something cool going on in the movie, something that's accessible and seems not like a blockbuster because this is a micro budget movie, mm-hmm. but something that seems like a movie you might watch with friends, but then that also has a lot of extra heft to it. I think that's kind of my sweet spot a lot of times.
Yeah, I think you're right. Looking back at like previous years movies on the lists, I mean, we both were into The Matrix and Fight Club, but those are kind of examples of what I think you were talking about, where
yeah,
it's fun and exciting, but yet it leaves you with some depth.
Yeah.
It triggers you intellectually as well as all those other great things that people go to watch movies for.
Yeah. That kind of what you think of when you say movie magic, that's here.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of extra subtext added on to that. And creatively, I think it's one of, if not the most risky mm-hmm. movies of the year.
Well, it can't be that risky if it's made for less than $500,000.
Creatively risky. Creatively risky.
I think that the noir is why this movie works so well. I mean,
yeah.
If you didn't have that and it was just like high school kids running yeah. around and doing stuff, it wouldn't, it's like this perfect postmodernism,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the postmodernism lane, because you're saying, how can I make a noir? Well, I'm going to put it in a totally different context. How can I make another high school movie? Well, I'm going to mash it up with noir.
Yeah.
A critic that I read recently said that that's what our age is the mashup age.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think that's
the post-Tarantino age, you know, where he comes around and just kind of borrows and steals from a bunch of things in the past and puts them all together.
Mm-hmm.
You see that a lot nowadays.
Yeah, you do. Again, I think that's been throughout time and art, but that's...
Yeah, so kind of filtering high school through the noir is funny in a way, and things stand out as funny, and he plays up sort of the joke of it, like the kingpin here is eating a giant chocolate chip cookie as he's talking business mm-hmm. with somebody. You know, his mom pours him a drink out of like this rooster decanter.
I love that.
I mean, it's full
it's
of
apple
humor,
juice.
But at the same time, it doesn't feel like a stretch. What he's doing is, you know, saying like this person represents this in this world and that person represents that. And I buy into all of it, plus all the heartbreak and growing up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My number one, Brokeback Mountain. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. We did a whole episode on it. So the only thing I'll add is that, especially pit against these other four nominees, three of which, Crash, Munich, and Goodnight and Good Luck, I don't even think are in the same league to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it didn't win, it confounds me. Mm-hmm. It confounds me. So I'm here to set the record straight.
Mm.
You want to talk honorable mentions?
Yeah. So let's see. I mean, the movies that you included there are certainly good honorable mentions. One of my favorite scenes of the year was in Pride and Prejudice. First of all, I'm a big fan of Joe Wright's slow, long camera shots going through the house, which he then doubles up and does even better in Atonement, which I can't wait to get to Atonement. I'm sure you... Do you like
I'm
Atonement?
A fan. Oh,
do you
yeah.
like it? Okay, good. Yeah. I was going to say. I'm already scoffing at your choices for that year if you don't pick Atonement. Actually, I don't know if I'll make it number one or not, but I think I probably will. Anyway, Pride and Prejudice... Keira Knightley and McFadden, I forget what his name is. Anyway, Darcy and Liz Bennett are just yelling at each other in the rain. I mean, the way that they match each other intellectually, they're so like, they're so angry at each other. They're talking so fast. And I just think the acting is stupendous. The visuals are great throughout the movie, and it's just one of those feel-good movies that's sort of like in the category you posted on Facebook a while ago, like, what's your comfort food? This is like sort of in that category to me.
Really?
Watching this movie. I've seen this like five or six times, you know, over the years, and I don't know, I like it a
lot. There's something with me where when you get into that costume drama territory, yeah. and it's all about like, manners and talks in the rain and love, like, but in a certain
love,
not love on a grand scale, but love as in like, I love this guy, but he's in a different class, so I can't really be with him. I shut off.
I think what's interesting about it is though, like, little things matter so much. Like,
yeah, I guess.
You know, he helps her into the carriage, and there's the close up of his hand afterward, because like, he can sort of still feel it, because, you know, it was so, everything's
like
forbidden.
That small intimate, even though it's fleeting and impersonal.
The little nuances there, I think, make for some surprising drama, you know, to our age. I guess the Constant Gardener, I thought, was very well shot. Did you watch that one?
I don't think so.
I really liked it, actually. I was, when I saw it, I thought, that's a candidate for the top five. And then it kind of slowly slipped down the list. But yeah, I did think that the storytelling was strong. The ending is great. And the, like I said, the visuals are good. How about you? What are some honorable mentions?
Capote was the one of the five nominees that I thought was close to making my top five. It's in my 10. And then all those blockbusters that we did episodes on,
King Kong,
Batman Begins, Revenge of the Sith, even Sin City, they're all sort of in the latter half of my top 10. 40-Year-Old Virgin is one to mention too. But The Squid and the Whale, did you get around to watching?
I haven't seen it. There's no filter for it, so I didn't ever get around to it.
Yeah, Noah Baumbach. Marriage Story is my favorite.
I love Marriage Story, so I am sad that I didn't get around to that one.
Yeah, that's my favorite of his catalog. But The Squid and the Whale, you can see where this guy's style is coming from. And, you know, he's got that focus on these like New York City intellectuals, similar to Woody Allen in that way.
Yeah.
But watching this again, I realize it's kind of in a certain way about pop culture criticism, which doing this show made it stand out a little bit, because it's also full of contradictions, because it almost has this idea in it that being a quote intellectual equates to living a serious life, because it puts you on this, in this position to be judge, you know, where you're not participating, you're an observer. And so you're able to judge things and say what's good and what's bad. But in reality, all that really does is separate you further and further from people, but also from real experience. And so like in the movie, you see that through like books and stuff. And this Jeff Daniels character, he's kind of influencing the Jesse Eisenberg character who plays his son, and just trying to indoctrinate him in all of his ways of thinking. And so there will be certain books that he'll tell his son to not even read, because he'll say, oh, that's minor Dickens. You don't want to deal with a minor Charles Dickens book. And so his son won't read them. And then it kind of makes you think about what we call today toxic fandom, which I think this movie is sort of dealing with in an interesting way 15 years ago. Like, what does it mean to kind of be above art that we got into supposedly because we loved it, but these people are not deriving any joy from art anymore. Hmm. So I was a big fan of that. And Transamerica, I thought, was very good.
I didn't
good
see that.
Also. And Red Eye. Did I mention Red Eye?
I think you did. Yes, Red Eye.
What other categories or movies or people are you kicking or keeping?
Yeah. I'm looking at the Oscar list right now. Honestly, I wasn't really that excited about all the Oscar nominations that North Country got. It was not even close to being in the consideration for me. Michelle Williams was actress in a supporting role, and I thought she was really great. Rachel Weisz was good in Constant Gardener, though, for a supporting actress. Cinematography was won by Dion Beebe for Memoirs of a Geisha, which I did see, but wasn't really a big fan of. Robert Elswit, Good Night and Good Luck, was better than that. The New World, though, Emmanuel Lubezki was a cinematographer with Terrence Malick. I think that should be number one for cinematography.
Yeah.
Followed by close second by Janusz Kaminski for Munich, and that didn't even get nominated. So those are two pretty glaring ones to me. What about you?
For Best Actor, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote, but I'm going to give it to Ledger in Brokeback Mountain. Mm-hmm. And I'll kind of easily kick Reese Witherspoon for Best Actress from Walk the Line.
I agree.
And give it to Felicity Huffman for Transamerica. She's great in that. I think she's a legit standout. Witherspoon is the best thing about Walk the Line.
It is.
And maybe that's what makes her stand out so much to the Academy, but I don't really get it.
I mean, the character that she's playing is really charming, and you know, she has this real star quality.
She's the light of the movie.
Absolutely. But the character is kind of like, you never understand why she would go along with him.
Yeah.
He's making these like weird jokes in bed, and he's so childish, the character Joaquin Phoenix plays, Johnny Cash. And she just like shows up in random places in his life, and like she got divorced and all these things. You never explain her. You never really get to know like her depth of character beyond her relationship with Johnny Cash. It just felt kind of a missed opportunity there. I kind of wish there was a movie about her instead of about him in some ways.
Yeah.
But anyway, Reese Witherspoon is fun, but I don't think.
Give her a Best Actress for Election or something.
I would pick Keira Knightley over Reese Witherspoon. Just the ones that were nominated.
Easy kick, Crash for Best Screenplay. Get that out of there and get Rian Johnson in there for Brick.
That is a pretty amazing screenplay with all that.
So unique, so cool, so stylish, and Crash. I'd also kick William Hurt, his nomination for Best Supporting in A History of Violence, and I'd get Ed Harris from the same movie in
there
instead.
Very short performance by William Hurt, but I love it, and I think it deserves to stay in there.
Best Art Direction. Tell me if this would be crazy. Is it crazy to kick Good Night and Good Luck and replace it with Sin City?
Yeah, it's interesting when you put in, I mean, why wouldn't that be visual effects? Because it's mostly the visual effects that would be of interest, but once you get into the technical stuff, I'm kind of out of my league here.
Yeah, I guess I just think of visual effects as additions to a world and not the world itself. And in Sin City, I guess everything is a special effect except for the living people and, you know, what they're holding. If they're holding a steering wheel, that's real. And then everything else around them is fake. But I don't know. Good Night and Good Luck looks great, but I just wanted to find some place to give Sin City some notoriety because it's another one that's just very creatively daring and does its own thing. And the last one, we don't talk about documentaries, but glaring mistake here. Glaring, huge. March of the Penguins wins Best Documentary. Grizzly Man, not even nominated.
Grizzly Man is in a lot of best movies of the decade,
couple, not even nominated,
2 decades worth. I keep finding that show up. I still have not seen it, but yeah, it's interesting. You talked about that movie's going to be a footnote. Which one were you saying that about?
I've said it about a lot, but Crash is going to be the answer to a trivia question.
Yeah.
Brick is a movie people will watch.
Well, I don't know about Brick, but.
Oh, no, it is for sure. And this is the same thing. I mean, Grizzly Man is a movie that will be watched.
Certainly,
and March of the Penguins, you know, it's a nature documentary.
A lot of staying power with Grizzly Man, apparently. So with directing, I mean, Terrence Malick didn't get nominated. I think that he could be over Bennett Miller Capote, over Paul Haggis Crash, over George Clooney, Good Night and Good Luck. I mean, similar to Spielberg with Munich, similar to Ang Lee with Brokeback Mountain. But I think the Oscars just plain flat out got a few things wrong.
I think that they did. And just with that documentary discussion, if you think about the fact that March of the Penguins is kind of this feel good, happy penguins protecting their young, and Grizzly Man is about how nature does not care about you. And, you know, the world is complicated and sometimes dark, and we could try to force ourselves into it, but at the end of the day, we're not in charge. I think that says something about the Oscars outlook, that one wins for Best of the Year and one is not even considered.
I think you had to wear very thick coats and lots of socks to film March of the Penguins. It would probably be pretty brutal. You know, that's where you get like ice crystals in your nostrils and stuff.
Yeah.
So that deserves something.
So they should get recognition.
It deserves something. Yeah.
Okay.
Golden Takes.
Yeah. What a year for blockbusters, for one. Batman Begins, Revenge of the Sith, and King Kong together, just those three movies, $470 million budget between the three of them.
What was the box office?
Insane. I didn't pull the box office, but $470 million for three movies. That's crazy.
You could make 1,000 bricks for that.
Oh, man. Yeah, probably more. And another rough year for horror. Looking through, Red Eye I liked a lot. It's very good, but it's kind of more of a thriller than a horror. The Exorcism of Emily Rose is interesting, but it's like kind of a courtroom drama, and it's got its own issues. George Romero's Land of the Dead. It's not really a standout George Romero, but it's like not one of his best. And then there's a bunch more remakes, which are very of their time, you know, with House of Wax and Dark Water and Amityville and The Fog. And then we're going to get even more of that next year. And we had even more in 2004. So like, this is the stretch for horror remakes. And also we're right in the thick of it as far as the very, very gory, tortury horror movies go.
The torture ones don't get me.
Hostel, not my cup of tea. That's going to be in 2006. But my favorites of this year are probably Wolf Creek and The Devil's Rejects. And both of those are pretty brutal, but I think that they kind of reflect what's going on because Saw was 2004, Hostel's 2006. Like, this is the pocket when we're obsessed with remaking the old movies from the 70s and the 80s, but also making everything way, way more brutal.
When do we get Hot Fuzz? 07, I think.
Something like that. It's not, I mean, like, it's not really a horror.
Shaun of the Dead, is that a horror?
It's more of a horror than Hot Fuzz.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that. So my golden take is that there should be more movies about making a living. It's like a form of survival movie. This is where Cinderella Man was so influential or so impactful to me. It's about a dad struggling with his job. They can't afford food. Like, that struggle to provide basic necessities is not in that many movies. But talk about like a real world, you know, working man kind of struggle. You know, we haven't seen a lot of those movies. In America comes to mind, which I did like a lot and could have been in the top five a couple years ago. But North Country is kind of about that. I'm going to say Pride and Prejudice a little bit because you have to get married to make a living when you're...
That's a stretch,
They're
Brian.
All stretches. They're all stretches. Pursuit of Happiness is about making a living. That's in 06, and I do like that a lot. So here's a few others that we've done episodes on that I want to know. Do you think this is a... Is this
making a living movie.
Is this a making a living movie?
Okay.
Requiem for a Dream. Drug Dealing.
No.
That's 2000.
Nope.
Billy Elliot.
No.
I mean, you got the...
Nope.
Again, these
it's
are
about,
stretches.
It's about passion. It's about chasing your passion, much like Requiem for a Dream is about chasing your passion for drugs.
How about Monster?
Monster.
It's more than the other couple.
Yeah.
But this is the level that you have to stretch to find another good movie about about making a living, at least among like Oscar kind of candidates.
Monster is more about power dynamics.
It is.
I think. But it does start in that sort of money as necessity kind of thing. Violence as a you know what I'm trying to say.
You're trying to find a way to make enough money to have shelter.
Yeah.
That's a very basic struggle, primal kind of fear that, you know, you don't have somewhere to sleep or some, and so anyway, Monster, I think sort of works. School of Rock, you know, he's trying to make a living getting a job as a teacher. Not really.
No.
American Splendor.
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti's character. He's poor. He's trying to find a way to make a job.
Yeah.
And then the clear one is Pirates of the Caribbean. Jack Sparrow's trying to make some money.
I guess so.
All right. So in the next episode, we're done with 05. Next episode, we talk about The Queen, the Best Picture nominee from 06. Helen Mirren is Queen Elizabeth II. And Helen Mirren won Best Actress for this.
Helen Mirren. Oh, yeah. You can find us at bestpicturethis.com on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you listen. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Best Picture This. And for 16 years of Golden Take, head over to the Letterboxd/Mike Cavalieri.
To help choose a bonus episode, go to patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. And also please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
So if you're looking for a great movie, don't pass by the best movie of 2005.
Brokeback
Mountain.
The
New World.